Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. It's beautiful outside. The sun is shining, and it's not 0 degrees, but it's not that warm either. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, and in memory of those 17 people that lost their lives on Thursday and Friday, and those children that are still in the hospital, I would like to tell everybody that Parkland's Run for Beagle, Scott Beagle, was a cross-country coach, and 16 other victims. They are running at the Pine Trails Park Tuesday, February 20th at 5 p.m. Runners all around the nation will be outside running for their coach, Scott Beagle. So in the memory of all these people and hoping that this never, ever happens again, I hope everybody joins them. And if there are any questions on my Facebook wall, I will take them. And right now I would like to introduce somebody very special. John Vanderslice is here. And the first question I want to bring out is, we're talking about the last words of Oscar Wilde. With what's happening in the news all over the world, there are so many people that do not accept others for who they are and how they want to conduct their lives. How does this pertain to Oscar Wilde, the man who was arrested because he wanted to be with a man?
Right, yeah, that's a good question. It certainly feels pretty relevant to me when in looking back over the case of Wilde, as I did for my book. In some ways, it was kind of like Back to the Future, because especially even increasingly so, it seems like ever since the election of 2016, there's been, at least in certain quarters of this country, permission to express kind of extremist views that we thought we were over. And so while certainly in the last 10, 15, 20 years, this sort of overt discrimination and persecution of people who are gays seems to have gone down in the Western world, just in the last year or two, there's been a sort of return to intolerance. And so I think the case of Oscar Wilde is even more relevant than ever, certainly as a cautionary tale, if nothing else.
I definitely agree. And, you know, there are a lot of people everywhere that don't accept it. And it's really sad because everybody is entitled to be whoever they want to be.
Right,
and
absolutely.
Be with whoever they want to be. So we said, how does this novel lends itself to what we hear in the news about people having different preferences? Why did you decide to spotlight Oscar Wilde and his work? And I love his work.
Well, so do I. I, of course, like most people, got interested in Wilde just by reading his plays and his fiction and his poetry. And this was, for me, actually, a couple decades ago, when I was in grad school at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, I was studying creative writing, and I was reading many authors who I felt I needed to learn, and Wilde was one of them. And so, of course, after you start to read an author, you get interested in their biography. So I was just reading over these quick sketches of Wilde's life, and I just noticed that there's a lot of detail about his life up until the point when he gets out of prison. Of course, he served 2 years of hard labor in a variety of English jails. It's just a miserable 2 years, and then he gets out. And what I heard was okay. And then 3 years later, he died. And so even back then, I was thinking to myself, well, what were those last 3 years like? His life completely changed. He went from being on the top of the mountain, a very famous, well-regarded author, and a wealthy man, and he went into prison and came out on the absolute lowest rung of society. He had no money, no reputation, no one wanted to be seen with him. And I just wondered, what would that have been like for 3 straight years? And so that idea, that question was in the back of my mind for years. And finally I got around to wanting to answer that question. And so I researched into Wilde's biography, and especially those last 3 years of his life.
Wow, that is interesting. I don't think very many people really know a lot about Oscar Wilde or about his life. And
right.
When I read your book, I was like, yeah, this was like eye-opening. So
yes.
He wrote a lot of poems and stories and other writings that he was noted for. Which ones would you say are the most notable? If somebody didn't know anything about him, where would they start?
Well, probably a good place to start would be his novel, A Picture of Dorian Gray. It's a very famous novel. It's the only one he wrote. And it's a very well-written novel, but interesting in many ways, besides just being a good read. There's characters in there that you're kind of tempted to say, oh, is that sort of Wild in Disguise, or someone wild new in disguise? Again, it's a really good story. It also came up in his trial offered as proof that he was definitely homosexual, because there were various strains of homoeroticism that readers picked up on in the novel that, of course, Wilde denied in court, but it was still evidence presented. But it's also just a great story, and a very kind of creepy horror, almost magical kind of horror story that almost anyone could read and enjoy. He was probably after that most famous for his plays. He really started to be very successful and make a lot of money when he started writing comedies in the 1890s that were sort of cheeky criticisms of upper crust society in England. The one that's most remembered is The Importance of Being Earnest. Many people read that in school. There's been various film adaptations of that play. It's a great play, a funny play, kind of a dark play, but as in most comedies, everything kind of works out in the end. There's an interesting connection between that play and his life, in the sense that when that play had just opened and was doing wonderfully on the stage in London, when the trial started in 1895, that finally brought Wilde down and led him to going into prison. So that was the zenith of his success as an author, just before his life crashed. So both for that sort of biographical reason and for the play itself, The Importance of Being Earnest is a must read.
Well, I read The Portrait of Dorian Gray a lot, and I have to tell you that as an educator, the second year I taught, they gave me the best class in the whole school. They never had a group like that. Like for 2 years in a row, they were shocked because these kids were so smart. So I read it with them in sixth grade. And nobody reads that in the sixth grade. I read To Kill a Mockingbird, too. I read a whole bunch of stuff. And my principal looked at me and I go, and your point? I said, these children have like between 11th and 12th grade reading levels. I'm not going to read, you know, Dick and Jane. And I'm not going to read grade 6 books. I'm going to pick out books like Little Women, Little Men, the original. And when we read Dorian Gray, and I liked it, and I read the book about Oscar Wilde, I realized that a little bit of Dorian Gray was in Oscar Wilde because he wanted to stay young. And he never wanted to get old.
Yeah, that's probably true. Supposedly there's different theories about who Dorian Gray is based on, who in Oscar's real life he's based on. But I guess I think you're probably right. In a general sense, there's a bit of every character inside the author. And the desire to stay young, that's probably true. That's very true.
Especially the ending that really, I kind of closed my eyes. It's a good thing it was a book, because I saw the movie. I was like, oh, my God. The ending was perfect, because in everybody's life, that's probably what happens. So why Oscar? Why not Bosie? Why didn't they pick on him? They didn't arrest him. How come he was
immune to
what was happening?
Well, let me back up just a little bit in case people don't know all the details. Wilde in the 1890s was living in London, married, had two sons, but had been introduced, although secretly carrying on a gay life, which that happens, and it did happen then. He was introduced, I believe, in 1891 to Lord Alfred Douglas, who was nicknamed Bosie. And Bosie Douglas quickly became the most important person in Wilde's life, and they essentially became a couple. And it was kind of an open secret in London at the time that they were a couple. Bosie's father was so, John Douglas, was so angry at Wilde associating with his son, and of course assumed their relationship was a gay relationship and blamed Wilde for the relationship, although Bosie had been active as a homosexual before he even met Wilde. He left an angry note in Wilde's club in London accusing him of being a sodomite. And Wilde was just abashed and deeply embarrassed, and he thought he couldn't let this stand because he thought he was kind of pulling this off, right? Living a secret gay life, but no one knew it, and his external life was as a married man and a father and a successful author. So he took John Douglas, Bosie's father, to court and with the charge of libel. Well, to defend himself, John Douglas and his lawyers were very aggressive and brought in many witnesses that could testify to Wilde actually living a gay life, a secret gay life. And as a result, John Douglas was acquitted, and Wilde sort of was the one actually on trial in that trial. And the English government then proceeded to almost immediately arrest Wilde and put him on trial for being gay, and it took two court cases for him to get convicted, but he was convicted finally. Why not Bosie? Well, John Douglas had Wilde in his sights all along. He is the one that he blamed for his son's predilection, even though, and here's the sad and curious thing about John Douglas, his older son Francis was also rumored to be homosexual and supposedly having an affair with the prime minister at the time, Archibald Primrose. Yes, he actually died in 1894 in rather suspicious circumstances that at the time and now we pretty much suspect he committed suicide. It was a gunshot wound and supposedly an accident, but it was rather suspicious, and it's assumed now that he committed suicide because the fact of this affair with the prime minister was about to come out. At least that's what he was afraid of. Well, so John Douglas blamed the prime minister for his older son's being gay, and then blamed Wilde for his younger son Alfred being gay, and he was just so furious he was not going to let Wilde get off. And it's been said that the English government would have been happy after the first trial in which Wilde was the defendant and it was a hung jury. Many in the English government would have been content to just give it up and say that Wilde had suffered enough and his reputation had been damaged enough. But apparently John Douglas threatened to out the prime minister if they didn't pursue Wilde to the end. So that's what they did, and he was convicted and went to prison for 2 years. But Bosie was never the one put on trial. Wilde tried to protect Bosie. When evidence was brought up in court about what he and Bosie had been doing, Wilde sort of explained it away in ways in which took any kind of suspicion away from Bosie. He wanted to bear the brunt of this himself and let Bosie be safe, which he was. So that's how it all worked out.
Well, that was his loyalty, but it didn't get him too far if you get to know Bosie better. Seriously. Yeah. So,
true.
In other words, there were actually laws that said that you couldn't be gay back then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I wonder what would happen if there were laws today that you couldn't be gay, what they would do protesting alone.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay.
Oh. Well, in certain states in the United States, the anti-sodomy laws have only in recent decades been tossed out, and there may be some still on the book somewhere that aren't really enforced. Well, the scary thing is that Wilde was what he was actually convicted of was a charge of gross indecency, which basically meant they knew he was gay, but they couldn't prove he committed sodomy. But if they somehow could have proved that he committed sodomy, he would have gotten a life sentence, pretty shocking. A life in jail for committing sodomy. So, but that was, you know, that was the world that existed then. And I don't think at the time it would have considered that unusual or that barbaric. I should say, though, that many people in London at the time knew that there was this sort of strata of gay men, and many of them had were married and had lives that sort of tried to disguise it, and although many were not married, and more or less, they were content to leave them alone as long as you didn't put it in their face. You didn't make it obvious to society that you're homosexual and just totally unrepentant about it. So not many people actually were convicted under the law, but there was always the threat that you could be convicted. And that in Wilde's case, that's what they did. I think possibly they wanted to make an example of him because he was such a public person. I think that probably had a lot to do with it as well.
That's scary.
Yeah.
He got married, though. Sort of like a camouflage, you might say. And he had two children.
Right.
And they failed. But his children, how did his children feel about the fact that their father, you know, and mother didn't get, you know, he was gay?
Yeah. That's a good question. Well, the way I present it in the book and the way I read it and the way many people have read it looking at Wilde's life is that when he got married, he actually thought he would remain married and be faithful. He actually had a lot of affection for Constance Lloyd. That was her maiden name. And they did get along quite well. He was a very eligible bachelor. And he, you know, met many ladies, tried out many different possible life partners, and it was just a thing that, of course, an eligible bachelor would settle down and get married, and he did. And they had two sons pretty quickly. Their names were Cyril and Vivian. And according to what most accounts, the main one being a book that Vivian Holland is the name that he finally published under, his younger son Vivian. He wrote a book about Wilde and about being Wilde's son. In fact, it's called The Son of Oscar Wilde. And according to Vivian, Wilde was a very devoted father, a very loving father, as you would expect, not a terribly stern father. But he was definitely also an absent father for long stretches. Neither they nor their mother saw Wilde, and when Constance realized that her husband was in fact didn't just associate with gay people but himself was gay, it's not clear. Certainly by the time he was convicted that was clear, but she seemed to hold him in for most of the marriage.
I think it's your phone this time, not mine.
Oh,
can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Yeah.
Okay, now that's better. I know it's not this phone this time. At least I hope not. I'm gonna make it louder. Okay, that's
better. Yeah, okay.
Tell us. There were two men in this story that have a major role. And that was Maurice Gilbert, and he was using him. How was he using Oscar? And then tell us about Frank Harris and his friendship with him.
Yeah, okay, sure. Maurice Gilbert, that's one way of viewing the scene that I write in the novel where Wilde asks Maurice, you know, if I could buy you anything, if you could receive any kind of gift, what would it be? And Maurice thinks and then asks for this bicycle that he saw in a Paris shop recently with nickel-plated handlebars. And so Wilde, totally to the surprise of Maurice, goes out and buys him this bicycle. That was an actual relationship that's documented, but most of what happens there, and the gift of the bicycle is true, it's sort of my imagining of imaginative recreation of their relationship. And I couldn't find a lot of information about Gilbert except that he was a soldier, and that's true, and that's in my book. And he after their relationship became very romantic, he had to go away and leave Paris for army reasons. And so I sort of try to imagine them as a couple before that happens and how devastated
mm-hmm.
Wilde was when Joe Barry went away. I don't know, I wasn't trying to make it seem like he was using Wilde for the sake of the present, although
mm-hmm.
I could easily see how it could come across that way. I kind of try to portray him as a very naive man, which is odd for someone in the army, but that I like that kind of tension. Frank Harris, like Maurice Gilbert, was a real person and a close friend of Wilde's. He was a journalist, born in Ireland, but moved to America as a young man, studied law in America, graduated from the University of Kansas, started practicing law in the United States, and then decided he didn't really like it. So he moved back to Europe and decided to be a writer instead. And he finally made a name as a journalist for the Saturday Review. And that's the capacity in which he finally got to know Wilde. And where Harris becomes important is that at one point when Wilde was living in Paris, after he's out of prison, and this is where my book is called The Last Days of Oscar Wilde, and it's pretty much all about his life after prison and mostly in Paris. And he's complained to Harris that he's too sad, Paris is too gloomy, and Maurice Gilbert has left, and he's just heartbroken, and he can't write.
Mm-hmm.
And Harris kept badgering Wilde to write because he admired Wilde as an author more than anything else and felt that if Wilde would just write again, the world would sort of have to come to terms with him. And Wilde kept saying, no, I'm too depressed. And so Harris just decides to take Wilde to the south of France for a vacation and says, okay, now you're in the south. You're not in Paris anymore. You got to write. And it becomes a sort of theme in the book, Harris badgering Wilde to write and Wilde refusing to write. That, according to Harris, who wrote a memoir about Wilde a couple decades after Wilde's death, that was sort of the context, the energy in their relationship. He was constantly trying to get Wilde to write, and Wilde was refusing. So that's certainly drawn from real life.
So why did Oscar write a poem about someone in his family? Why did Bosie write a poem about someone in his family? And why did Oscar feel that he was, you know, upset? He thought he was writing about him.
Right. That's a scene early in the novel. And to set that up, I should explain that after Wilde got out of prison, pretty much everyone in his life assumed that he and Bosie Douglas were done. It ruined his life, that relationship, and he had supposedly sworn off Bosie and felt used by Bosie. And that's the way it was for a while, but finally he found the he was just that relationship was just too important to him. He was still addicted to Bosie in a weird way. So they reunited in Rouen, France, briefly, and then later they were living together in Naples, in Italy. But finally they separated. Finally they really did separate for good. Both men decided this was just not a relationship that was good for them. And separately they moved to Paris. And so they did see each other in Paris and were more or less on civil terms. So early in my book, I have Wilde going to visit Bosie with Robert Ross. And Ross and Douglas knew each other very well, but had become kind of frenemies, competitors at that point. And Bosie Douglas was a poet, published poet, published a few books in his life. And so Wilde asks him about what poems he's working on. So Bosie reads some of his poems, and there's one that is a beautiful sonnet to a friendship that has lasted a long time, and the author's realizing how important it is. And Wilde just assumes he must be writing this about me, right? Because, I mean, who else is important in his life, has been so important to his life as me? But then after he reads it and is clearly and sees how Douglas sees how moved Wilde is, he says, he explains that he actually was written to his cousin, Lionel Johnson, who was a real-life person who was Douglas's cousin, in fact, introduced Douglas to Wilde.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I guess the reason why Wilde would have assumed that poem was written to him, I think that was simply his mindset, that he couldn't imagine that, or didn't want to imagine that someone else actually an important chapter in the book, because there's some important tensions between Wilde and Douglas and Ross and Douglas that carry over to the rest of the novel.
So where they created the dialogue between them, why does it appear that Oscar Wilde couldn't accept being rejected by Bosie or anything like that? He just felt that he couldn't even move on. He couldn't even move on with his life. How come?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I think many people would have asked him that. The way I kind of explain it to myself and explain it to other people is that I think it really was like a kind of addiction. And even when things were very kind of hot and heavy between them, they fought a lot. And people really people didn't like Bosie Douglas and told Wilde that and really thought he was spending way too much time with Douglas and it was not good for him. And but Wilde was just completely sold on Douglas as being the most important person to his life. So much so that for many months on end, he would never go home. He wouldn't see his wife, wouldn't see his kids. He claimed when she asked him once, "How come you haven't been around at all?" He claimed to have forgotten where he lived because he had not been home in so long. He was spending all the time with Douglas, I mean, all his free time. And I think when you're that sort of involved, in a weird way, it's sometimes even worse for with a bad relationship. You just get sort of addicted to it, and he couldn't finally get it out of the system. Even to his deathbed, actually. On his deathbed, this is true, he got, Douglas sent him 50 pounds as a sort of courtesy gift from an old friend, and Wilde is so excited that Douglas hasn't forgotten him, and he's still, Bosie is still around, still in his life, still thinking about him, and it's because Wilde never finally got over that relationship, although he did. You know, he got romantically involved with Maurice and flirted with many people. That finally was the relationship that sort of marked him, and then he took with him to the grave.
So at one point, it appears that Oscar feels that he's entitled to money because Robbie convinces him that Bosie owes him money. As a matter of fact, it seems throughout the book that Oscar Wilde can't accept the fact that he's getting older also. That seems to be a theme that bothers everybody, trust me.
Yeah.
You meet somebody on the street and they go, "Oh, you look a little older." Like, "Oh, shut up, I didn't ask you that. You know, I don't care." I mean, you get on the phone with an insurance company like I did yesterday. "What's your date of birth?" I said, "I really don't remember." And it doesn't concern you. And that's the first question. And all of a sudden they talk to you like, "Oh, do you understand me?" "Definitely not." So why does it appear that, you know, who is this Robbie, and why didn't he want to create more poems of his work? He appeared defeated throughout the entire thing, and that bothered me. So I wanted to shake him and say, "Oscar, write something for us. We need to hear your voice."
Right, and it's kind of hard not to sympathize with Frank Harris and his continually badgering of Wilde to write again, because you look from our point of view, why wouldn't you write again? I mean, you're still Oscar Wilde, you're still alive, you still have your own brain, your mental facilities, why wouldn't you? Robert Ross was long-term friend of Wilde, although younger than Wilde by several years, became the most important person in his life. He was one of two men that were with him when he died, and he became Wilde's literary executor. And he was a friend before I went to prison, a friend during his time in prison, and one of his best friends coming out of prison. There's a scene in the novel, and this happened in real life, where Ross writes a letter to Wilde saying, "Bosie Douglas just came into a bunch of money from his father. Bosie and his father made up, and Bosie inherited money from his father, and in fact, Wilde was owed money because during the trials, Bosie's mother, who was divorced from John Douglas and who hated John Douglas as much as Bosie did, promised Wilde that if he pursued this libel case against Douglas, even if he lost, and they would pay all whatever it cost him to pursue this case, they were going to make it up to him. Wilde lost everything. Thousands of pounds, and he did get some money from Bozzi's mother, but not very much. And
mm-hmm.
that always stuck in his mind, and Ross reminded him of it. And when Douglas came into all this money that he inherited from his father, Ross said, look, go after him. Don't talk to him about it. And he tries. Well, does try to get that money back. As far as why he didn't write again, well, that's kind of an open question. My take on it is that at that point in his life, between 1897 and 1900, he, in his own mind, had suffered so much and had been so stigmatized by the world and by cut, as he said, by all of his old friends. He was tired, and he just felt like enjoying life as best he could in the circumstances he found himself. And so that's what he did. And it meant being kind of indulgent, drinking too much, sleeping too long, not really having a purpose in life, but just ready to give up that aspect of himself. Which I think, you know, as I was thinking about this, it's kind of a temptation for any gifted person who follows their gift. I think in the back of their mind, there's always that temptation to think, well, you know, I don't really have to do this. I could just stop writing, or stop acting, or stop making music. I just, you know, and my life would be a lot simpler. Well, not really. I mean, that's what you're called mm-hmm. to do. Not doing it really is a major defeat. And but I think Wilde was so downtrodden at that point, he was ready to stop and ready just to live and not worry at all about what he wrote. So that's what he did, right or wrong.
How did you create the rash? I'm trying to call on my cell phone, but for some reason my regular phone seems to, I don't know why. I haven't had trouble with it before. I have a little static. Okay. So how did you create the rash and the scenes with the Pope? Was that real?
Yeah, that happened. He did. In fact, whenever Wilde, the few times in his life that he traveled to Rome, he did try to see the Pope. He was also interested in Catholicism. He claimed that when he was in Oxford, he was ready to convert. The only reason why he didn't was because his father would be so angry, he would have written him off out of his will. But even after his father died, he didn't convert. He did go to Rome, and he had it when he went late in his life. And his life, what I document in the book, he did have a rash on his face. And according to Wilde's biographer, Peter Ellman, who wrote what was considered the sort of the standard critical biography of Wilde for decades, he went there repeatedly, several days in a row, went to see the Pope and get blessed by the Pope. And according to Ellman, Wilde felt that this was working. It was like magic, and his rash was going away. And I kind of tried to put a coy within the book. Does believe it's going away, but the man who's with him at the time, Reginald Turner, doesn't really see the same change, although he's willing to let Wild believe it, and that's what Wild believes. And I guess that's finally what I thought probably happened. Wild wanted to believe that Pope had this serum, and that's what he saw, whether it was true or not.
Hmm. But he wanted to believe. He didn't want to even face that there was something wrong with him. So who is Reggie, and what was his relationship with Oscar Wilde? He had a lot of different people that were related, you know, he had relationships with.
Reggie Turner was a journalist. He wrote for the Daily Telegraph in London. He, too, was much younger than Wilde, part of this younger case that Wilde was in London before he went to prison. And he and Ross were the two men that were most faithful to Wilde. They were the two that when he got out of prison and decided to
It was so sad because his last days were really filled with torment and feeling alone. And his illness was huge. And the doctor even said that he couldn't even, you know, his ears were normal. Actually, that wasn't normal. So if the doctor really was today, he would have been treated. But back then, he was not treated. So what did they miss? How did you create the final scenes? We hear him with Robbie. Well, before I forget, let me not forget. On Wednesday, we have The Book of Lovers by Bruno Ribeiro. On the 26th, we have New York Times author Vincent Zandri, The Detonator. On the 28th, The Voice Inside. What happens when a police officer knows that someone is a serial killer and he feels that he has to free him because he was framed? Find out when you read The Voice Inside by Brian Freeman. On the 6th, we have White Witch, but we're going to talk about Annie Palmer, the real White Witch, with Larry Thompson. And on the 1st, New York Times author, the biggest thriller writer in the entire universe, and probably the best criminal defense lawyer in the world, Philip Margolin, The Third Victim. And that's just some of, yeah. He emailed me and said, when's my interview? And I go, can I read the book first? It took me like, I couldn't put it down. It's scary. On the 8th, we have Death Theory. You don't want to read it. It's too scary, but it's really good. On the 15th of March, Look for Her. And on the 21st, I am totally honored. Mark Cameron, who writes with Tom Clancy, agreed to do an interview with me about Power Empire. And on the 26th, another award-winning author that is the greatest, Charles Salzberg, will be here for The Second Story Man. And what better way to start April than with Minister Sam Oliver? I asked him to do this because there's so much hate and anger in the world that I asked him to do a show with me for forgiveness and understanding and hope. And I just think that that's a great way to have a show and to talk about it. So, how did you create the final scenes where you hear him with Robbie and Reggie and his imaginings? Did that really happen? Did he really hallucinate and think that he was somewhere else? That was really good because I could picture that.
Speak to whatever was in his head, whoever was in his head.
tell us about the funeral and why so many people came. And did they come because they cared about him, or they came because they wanted to be seen?
Weird. Can you hear me? Okay, good. So I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about some of his poems and some of his quotes at the end. What did he mean by, "It is very painful for me to be forced to speak the truth. It is the first time in my life I've ever been reduced to such a painful position, and I'm really quite inexperienced in doing anything of the kind." I found that that quote applies to just a lot of people today, that when things get too difficult, they don't want to face it. Why would he write that, and how do you feel about that quote?
I have another quote that I think that applies to this also. I've now realized for the first time in life it's vital, the importance of being earnest. How does that apply to the people that he was friends with, and how would that apply to him? I can hear you. Now I can hear you a little bit better. So if Oscar Wilde had to sum up his life, how would he sum it up in like 10 sentences or 10 words? How would he sum up his life at the end? And would he say that if he could do it over, that he would have written and maybe not taken the road to not write anything anymore? I'm having trouble hearing you. I don't know why.
No.
That's better.
Can you hear me? I don't know. I'm waiting for him to call back in because for some reason we're having static again, and I don't know why this keeps happening. So I'm going to email him and ask him to please call back in. And hopefully John will call back in. But I'm having trouble hearing him. So before I forget, let me remind everybody that we'll be back on Wednesday, hopefully with no static again. And I'm going to email him. Call in. And see what happens. And I'm going to try to see if I can call him back in. I don't know if I can. I'm going to try to get his number and call in. I think I have it on this piece of paper. I don't know why this keeps happening on his line, but it does. We'll be back on Wednesday with the Bruno Romero, The Book of Lovers, and I'm going to try to call him back right now and see if I can get him on the phone using my phone to my line to call in. Let's see. Eight, nine. Let's see if I can get him back in. 1 7 dial.
Hello.
Hi, it's Fran. I can hear you now.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I just realized I thought the phone
I
was on was a good.
I called you. I never did that before, but I figured, let me see what happens if I call you. I got you.
Yeah, that's fine. It's great. I think my battery was my phone had a low battery all of a sudden, which is kind of surprising. I don't know why that would have happened, but that's probably
that's
what happened.
That's why I said, you know what, let me call him back. And I never did. I'm so impressed with myself because I actually did this. Okay, so if Oscar Wilde could speak and tell everybody that he wanted to change his life, would he do it the same way or would he give up the way he did?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the way I kind of process that is that I don't think he finally regretted sort of his decision in the last few years of his life not to write. But I do think he probably would have said, well, my life would have been a lot easier if I hadn't tried for the longest time to be a kind of conventional English gentleman. If I had just been who I was, which is sort of this alien from Ireland who lived in England for a long time and tried to fit in among sort of wealthy aristocracy in England. If I had just been this visitor from Ireland and been true to who I was, I would not probably have gotten into as much trouble as I did. And maybe in the end I wouldn't have felt so tired and so dejected and in the mood to sort of give up writing. Now I'm projecting here. I don't know if that's true. Wilde felt that way, but I think looking over what happened to him and the amount of regrets that certainly by the time he went to prison that he had stored up. I can't see him thinking any other way than that.
So who would you say was his closest friend that if he had to give an epitaph about him, what would they say? I thought about that while I'm sitting here trying to figure out how to get everybody back on the line.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sorry about that. I thought I had a good phone. Well, you know, as I said, Bosie Douglas was very, very important to him, and his central romantic figure in his life. But finally, he owed everything in the way at the end to Robert Ross, and Robert Ross is the one that he probably would have been felt inclined to write an epitaph for. gosh, I think he would have just said that he couldn't have survived without Ross's help. He was like the best friend anyone could have. And I think Ross did other things. You know, he ran an art gallery for a while, and he was a journalist earlier in life. But finally, I think in his mind, the most important thing he did was to be a close friend to Oscar Wilde and Wilde's confidant and literary executor and bank of last resort, too. I think he probably took more pride, Ross did, in that aspect of his life than anything else he did. And I don't think Wilde failed to realize that. And I think he would have expressed that sentiment to Ross. But you know, Ross and Douglas are these two, you know, friends that are kind of so central to Wilde's life, and they're at odds basically in my novel because they were so each in their own way so close to him, and in the same set of young men in London that Wilde liked to socialize with. And yet, in the end, the last few years, they become these enemies. And it's an interesting sort of social dynamic that I had a lot of fun with in the novel portraying.
Well, this sounds so much better. But I have there's another quote that I think before we end, we have about 5 minutes. This
sure.
applies today. This definitely applies today. This just proves to everybody that I do research. Ha ha. Ignorance is like a delicate, exotic fruit. Touch it, and the bloom is gone. But sometimes ignorance grows, unfortunately, and it fits to today. So why did he write that? And that's true.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Wilde was pretty canny. he was pretty smart.
Yeah, I know.
Sometimes he expresses things very kind of jokingly, but often, in doing that, he's cutting to a very crucial truth here. And I think in some ways, what that quote is getting at is that there's this sort of a kind of a beautiful happiness in naivete that Wilde appreciated when he saw it in other people. He really appreciated it. That's why the character of Maurice in my book, he is a sort of beautiful, naive kind of man. And I think Wilde responds to that because really at his heart, he was not the least bit naive. He was kind of cynical.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he recognized how if you sort of turn someone that's beautifully ignorant and make them jaded, what a kind of loss that is for them and for them. But I think that's probably what he's getting at in that quote.
Well, tell me. Some people, some actually say ignorance is bliss, and not really.
Right.
Sometimes you need,
right.
face. Yeah.
Yeah.
You need to face
well,
who
I
you
certainly
are.
Well, I would agree with that.
And
I would agree with that.
And if he were alive today, what would his words be to anybody in the gay community? What would he say? Just be who you are or hide it? I mean, I have cousins.
Well,
I have two cousins. My cousin Andrew is married to Nicole. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
I have friends that live used to work near me. And so what? That you're entitled to be who you are. What would he tell them today? Would he change?
Right.
Would he change? Would he hide it? Or would he just be the way he was and not care that he went to prison?
Right. Well, that's another good question. Well, I mean, I one thing I should say is that even when he was alive, Wilde did sort of predict that eventually, in the long run, culture would move in his direction, if you will, and get over its sort of prejudice. He did believe that. He didn't think it would happen in his lifetime, but he did predict to Frank Harris that Western world would sort of reclaim. He was enamored of the classical world, the Greeks particularly, because he thought in that culture being homosexual was permitted and almost expected. And he saw that he believed that eventually even English culture would sort of go back and understand that again. And so I think he would be very happy to say to anyone to be yourself. There's a famous quote he had about you all should be yourself because everybody else is already taken. Only you are yourself. And that's one of these famous Oscar Wilde quotes that gets around. And I think he really did believe that, and I think he would say that. And I think he would take great relief in the in the Western world, despite what we talked about earlier about sort of those prejudices sort of being permitted when it wasn't before. I think there's he would feel great relief that there's a lot more openness now than there used to be, and I think he would see it as proof that he was right all along. So I don't think he would tell anyone to hide anything. I think he would say, as I said earlier, if you hide, you're going to get yourself in trouble, because that's essentially what he did. He thought he could deny himself, and so he got married and thought he would make a good go of it. But within a couple of years of getting married, I think he realized that was a mistake.
So what is next for you, and where can everybody learn more about you and your work? And everybody, you need to read this book because it's fantastic. I loved it. And while you're at it, White Witch by Larry Thompson. Oh, my God. Alter Ego by Brian Freeman. That was one that I'm interviewing him May 7th, but I had to read it right away. Alice and the Assassin about Alice Roosevelt. It's interesting. And A Well-Timed Murder. Very interesting. But where can we find out more about you and your work? And what are you writing next that I'm going to get?
You can find out more about me. I have a website, johnvandersliceBooks.com. And right now what I'm working on is doing research for another historical novel that I'm planning and going to write. I'm thinking as I'm doing my research how I want to structure the book. But I haven't actually started the writing yet, so it may be several years yet before it appears.
Oh.
But the subject of the matter is Robert Stroud, who is better known as Birdman of Alcatraz. Very interesting man with as many complications as Oscar Wilde had, maybe even more. Very, very many-sided person. He had many admirers and also many detractors. So... I'm going to fictionalize him in a novel, but I have novels that I've written in the past that have not appeared yet, so if they get published in the next couple of years, I will let you know, and I'll have that up on my website, but you can find information about me and the books I have published and the events that I do throughout the year in my website, johnvandersliceBooks.com.
This has been so much fun. You have no idea. This has been great. And now that I've learned how to call somebody, that makes life so much easier that I don't have to worry. I'm going to tell everybody, I wasn't going to announce this, but I'm going to anyway. I'm going to do a show on March 12th that I'm going to, if I can figure out how to create it in a few minutes, on school safety and safety plans. As an educator for 36 years, in an inner city school in the Bronx, I never was afraid ever. And we had bomb threats and all sorts of stuff that we had, but I never was for 36 years ever afraid to walk into my school and afraid of any students. As a matter of fact, they wouldn't even dare start with me, they said. So I want to thank you so much. If I need somebody for panel shows, what type of panel shows would you be interested in joining us with? Because I do them a lot.
Sure. You mean panel shows on particular contemporary issues?
Literary issues, stuff that's out there, anything that I come up with. We've talked about, what would you be interested in?
Well, it's certainly anything related to historical fiction, if that's a subject you get into, because it's a genre I love. I write other kinds of genres as well, but it's certainly one I love.
Mm-hmm.
And also any shows connecting arts with contemporary culture or contemporary politics, so the place of the arts and the value of the arts.
That sounds good.
That I feel very, very passionately about those subjects and happy to talk about them.
Thank you so very much. I want to thank you so very much for today. I want everybody to buy The Last Words of Oscar Wilde. It's one of my favorite books. It's one of my one of my favorite books. Yes, it is. And I really hope everybody has a great day. And John, thank you so much, and bye.
Oh, thank you. Bye. Thanks.